This is the 4501 Podcast, Episode 6, Traveling the World with an Ocean Sciences Degree.
Hey Tony, how's it going?
I'm doing pretty well today. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. It's really wintry outside. It's like super cold, even more so than the last podcast we talked about.
Well, that's what you get for living in Baltimore.
Yeah, I know, right? But joining us today for this episode, we have someone who's not in winter weather right now, or he could be, I don't know. I'm sure we'll find out. Tony's friend Nick from back home in from Amish country, right?
We'll talk to Nick about that, but let me give him an introduction first. So Nick is a really good friend of mine. We grew up together in Reading, Pennsylvania, went to the same high school, and we're actually in the same kindergarten class. Nick went to college up in Kutztown University. He studied an ocean sciences degree there. We'll let him talk about that again in a couple minutes. But I wanted to pretty much tie in the topic of this episode, which is traveling the world with an ocean sciences degree. Nick has this ocean sciences degree, which has allowed him to travel to places such as Samoa, New Caledonia, New Zealand, Hawaii, Iceland, Greenland, Chile, Argentina, and honestly, the list goes on and on. He's been to sea on a ship for over 650 days since he has been in college. I can't think of something that I did for 650 days like that. I find that really fascinating and really cool. We'll definitely dive into that too. Nick currently lives in Bermuda. That's right, Bermuda, a foreign country. He's been living there for, I think it's over 3 years now. And he works on a 171-foot research vessel called the RV Atlantic Explorer, where he manages all the science technology on the ship. So it is my pleasure to introduce to you guys Nick Matthews. Nick, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good.
I think Mark was wrong earlier when he said you're in a much warmer place. Is that right?
Yeah, so actually I was lucky enough to come home to spend Christmas in Amish country.
Did Tony tell you about that rolling joke that we have?
No, what's that?
I just assume Redding is Amish country. I know it's not, but I love to mess with him and say that he's from Amish country.
Well, it's really funny. Where I got my degree at Kutztown University, I used to commute to work every day, and I would drive from Redding up to Kutztown, which is in the middle of farm country, and I'd be stuck in traffic on a highway behind a horse and buggy most days.
Oh my god, that's ridiculous. I would get so angry about that.
Yeah, it's crazy. They're out there on the highway even in 6 to 10 inches of snow.
Yeah, they're everywhere up there, especially towards Kutztown. But like I insist upon every episode that towards Reading, it's a city, it's built up, there's residential areas. You don't really find the Amish in that section of town.
If anyone's listening to this and they see Amish people in Reading, PA, please tweet us at the 4501 podcast to let Tony know that he's wrong.
Yeah, please prove me wrong, because that's something I've never seen.
Prove him wrong. No, I believe it. I believe it. Even though Tony denies it, I believe it.
Yeah, so actually let's talk about that real quick. It's really funny because Nick, what was your degree at Kutztown, Nick?
So I got a degree in oceanography with a concentration in physical oceanography.
Okay, and from what I understand, Kutztown, which is in Pennsylvania, which is a landlocked state, is really well known for its ocean sciences programs. Is that right?
That's right. So I'm one of only like a handful of people to graduate in recent history that I know of from Kutztown with an oceanography degree. And I got so many awesome opportunities while I was there. We have a field station down in Virginia. I got to go down and go out on a ship there. I got to do research at a NASA base where they were launching rockets to the International Space Station. The space station, or the, I'm sorry, the launch pad was right on the beach, and we would actually track the erosion of the beach there so that they knew, you know, how imminent the danger was of the coastline eroding their launch pad away. And then on top of that, I got to go to Hawaii and get on a ship and then sail for 6 weeks on this big 272-foot research vessel to Guam. And that was one of the coolest things that I did.
Do you guys get lost?
We did not get lost. No, we didn't. But some of the equipment that we deployed, we had this robot that was supposed to go down to the bottom of the ocean, drive around for a little bit, and then come back up. We did lose that temporarily, but we eventually found it.
So did you see, there's a movie that just came out recently. It's about like some girl sailing from like Hawaii to like California, and she got stranded. It's like based on a true story.
Was she by herself?
No, she's like with some other dude, but he got injured. I forget the name. Maybe it's called like Adrift or something like that.
Adrift.
It's killing me. It's with the girl from like The Fault in Our Stars. Okay, this doesn't matter. I just thought it was relevant.
You can look it up later, and we'll link it in the show
notes.
It's
called Adrift. Yeah.
Adrift.
People are sailing to California, and their ship gets messed up with a hurricane. Or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They just get stranded on a boat. But that didn't happen.
That did not happen. No, but I also do know some people, you know, that have been on ships that sank or were in the process of sinking and got off. And it's terrifying. It is. It is.
I cannot imagine that. That would be like super scary. That's like the first thing that comes to mind is Titanic, right? Like in the middle of the ocean, sinking ship, what do you do? Although nowadays you probably have like a lot of technology on board to help you in that type of situation.
Yeah, nowadays there's really no reason why a ship should sink out at sea. Usually when
hitting an iceberg.
I mean, hitting an iceberg, true. But I'm not sure if they even had, I don't think they had radar back then, if I remember correctly from the movie.
No, I think it's all observation. Can't see anything.
So,
right?
You know, one of the cruises that I was on in Iceland, we left Iceland and we went towards Greenland, and we were cutting through a channel that goes a fjord, actually, that goes all the way through Greenland. And it was so foggy that morning when we were approaching the coastline of Greenland. We couldn't see any of the icebergs. We couldn't see even the lands that we were approaching, and we had to go completely blind by radar to tell where we were. And as we were going in, we were all perched around the ship looking for icebergs. But you know, the radar does a really good job of picking up the ones that would sink you.
Oh, that's good. And now is that radar like proper radar, or is it like there's underwater radar too, which is that sonar?
So EMF waves don't really go underwater too well. So everything underwater is all communication underwater is based on sound for the most part. You know, but radar is something different entirely. So radar is just bouncing EMF waves off of things like, you know, the coastline or mountains or other ships or things like that.
And just for people who don't know, is EMF, is that electromagnetic frequency?
Or EM, yeah. Something like that, yeah.
okay. Good.
We're like 90% accurate.
Exactly. Radio waves is a simpler way to put it. Yeah.
Very good. Cool. So, yeah, I want to take a step back before we get too far into that and kind of talk about more your experience with Kutztown. And actually, let's go back a step further from that and talk about how you got into the science field to begin with.
So I went to college at first and I didn't really know what to do. I started attempting to be an engineer, and then I dropped that major and I was just undecided for a while. And when I would come home and veg out, I'd watch TV sometimes, and I'd watch the Science Channel, specifically the Through the Wormhole show with Morgan Freeman and that other one with that other guy. I can't think of his name right now.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh yeah. And and so I would watch those TV shows, and then one time Morgan Freeman was talking about the speed of light and how inconceivable the distance to the sun is, let alone the rest of the stars out there. And it's like 93 million miles to the sun. And, you know, that's such a long distance that it takes 8 seconds or minutes or something like that for light to travel that far. And that was just like a crazy fact that really stuck with me. And I remembered it. except I obviously didn't remember if it was a minute or a second. But the eight part stuck with me. And after hearing that, I went back to school, and I just happened to be taking astronomy at the time, but I was still undecided about if I wanted to go into science or engineering or anything different. And I was sitting in class, and you know, the teacher asked this question, and it was a very mathematical question, but it was basically like, how long does it take for light to get from the sun to Earth? And I immediately raised my hand and gave the exact right answer before anybody could even like grab a calculator. And it just like blew her mind. And after class, I went up to her and I was just like, you know, I went to her office hours and I, you know, started talking to her and, you know, showed that I was really interested in astronomy. And then, you know, being able to talk to like a real astronomy professor about that sort of stuff was really cool at that time. And then I was kind of hooked. So I, you know, this is also kind of how I got into oceanography too, because I was talking to this astronomy professor, and I would take up most of the time in her office hours. And there was a line of kids out the door that cared about their grades and, you know, had like logistical questions for the professor and wanted to like come in and figure out what, you know, what's going on with this last test or the homework assignment. And I was just in there shooting the breeze with the professor, you know, just wasting everybody's time. And so she was like, all right, well, we can't just sit here and talk all day. So why don't you go down the hall and talk to the oceanography professor? She needs somebody to talk to. So I did the same thing. And then, you know, the oceanography professor, Dr. Oakley, she was busy too, but she made time for me. And she saw that I was interested and kind of recruited me to be an oceanography student. And one of the ways she did that was inviting me on that cruise in Hawaii for 6 weeks.
Yeah, so I actually kind of have a similar experience with that too at Loyola. Like back in my pod, well, my episode, we talk about a little bit, but what we didn't get to talk about is how like I wanted to go to med school and I just hated people, so I didn't. And honestly, after that, I was just like, I don't know really what to do. And so what it turned out is that I actually just was talking to professors and I just developed relationships with them. And they said that, you know, science research is actually like a cool and fun avenue. I'm taking lab students. Just why don't you try it out for a semester or two and see how it goes? So like, I would say that a lot of those faculty members I still talk to today and we have great like friendships. It's actually really interesting to hear that you started off that way too.
Yeah. I mean, it was the... Obviously, I'm not the perfect student, and you can definitely ask that professor that question, and she'll agree. But I definitely was interested in the research and, you know, doing field work and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, and I think like the most important thing that I did in college was developing relationships based around the research that I was doing. And, you know, that's kind of like propelled my whole career. And that was one of the most important things that I've done.
That's really awesome to see like how powerful a mentor essentially can be in deciding your career path for both of you, honestly. That's really inspirational. And if there's anybody listening to this that is in a similar situation, I think the key takeaway here is to find a mentor or find somebody who is older than you, who has been through it, and you can kind of like tag along and learn from them and ultimately decide where you end up in your career.
Yeah. So I would say that like science is definitely one of that fosters younger generations. Like, honestly, it's actually somewhat egotistical where, at least in the science field, where you want your research project to live on forever, for perpetuity. And so the easiest way to do that is through your scientific progeny. Like, if you recruit people to lab, you train them, they'll take your research and keep working with it forever. So I think, I mean, that's pure, sometimes it's pure ego for the most part.
I definitely agree with that, yeah.
See, all science is somewhat related. Mm-hmm. Different fields, but the people don't really change that often. Mm-hmm.
Now, Nick, did you know about all these? Well, you said already that her name was Dr. Oakley. She kind of like recruited you to go on this trip to Hawaii on a research vessel. Did you know anything beyond that, like other opportunities, like this is what your career is actually going to look like? Because that's kind of how your career looks like now. You're on a ship every day. You're working in a tropical, well, not a tropical, you're working on an island somewhere, which we're going to talk about next. Like, but before we do that, did you know that that's where you were headed in that direction?
Absolutely not. I think the first time I was ever actually on a boat that wasn't like a ferry for cars or something like that was when I was 21, after my professor, you know, asked me to go to Hawaii. You know, there was a 6-month period after she asked me, you know, where we were preparing for the trip and everything. And in that time, we actually went down to the field station that Kutztown has. It's called Wallops Island, or it was called Wallops Island Field Station at the time, but now it's Chincoteague Bay Field Station. Mm-hmm. And we went down there, we went out on this little boat, and that was really the first time I was ever on a boat or a ship or of any kind besides a ferry. And I just like puked my brains out for 8 hours and just like stared at the shoreline, like wishing we would go back immediately. And, you know, if anything, I thought this was the only thing that I knew I wasn't going to do.
I'm surprised you stuck with it after that.
I mean, it's like the, you know, the science is really, you know, rewarding. It's meaningful and everything. I feel like, you know, I'm making a positive contribution to society. But also, it's just so adventurous and so exciting and everything. And, you know, and those two things together kind of like pulled me in, you know, and helped me get over the little issues that I had with seasickness or, you know, whatever obstacles were in my way. You know, the adventure and the excitement of all helped me overcome it.
Do you still get seasick now?
I still get seasick from time to time. I definitely haven't gotten over that completely. But once I saw that other people get seasick too, that do this for a living, I realized that I wasn't the only crazy person in the world.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, the waves get big, right? There's nothing you can do about that.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it seems like you graduated from Kutztown with your degree. You just said you did a little bit of internships, and then you came across, I guess somehow, this opportunity at BIOS, which stands for Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences. Could you talk about a little bit how you found about that opportunity and how you landed that job there?
Yeah, so the main factor about my resume that got me that job there was, you know, my experience. So, you know, my experience with going to Hawaii and doing that research trip with Dr. Oakley, the internship I did after that with the MATE program, which is Marine Advanced Technology Education, and then that was actually a 6-month at sea internship, and I got to work with tons of different, you know, elite scientists, and I got to work with tons of technicians and, you know, lots of people that are able-bodied seamen that work at sea for a living. And then after that internship, I got a quick little job at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute as a fill-in technician. And after all that, you know, there were only two full-time positions open in all of America for marine technicians, which is what I had been training to do through this internship. And one was at Oregon State and one was at Bermuda. And I got flown out to Bermuda to interview. And after I saw the place and saw how beautiful it was and saw that I could work there and live there and continue doing these awesome things, I was just completely sold, and I took the job immediately.
Yeah, Oregon versus Bermuda. That's like a easy choice to make, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's talk about BIOS, but I have one more question about your time at Kutztown. From what you said so far, it seems like your experience on the job, you can attribute that more to getting a job at BIOS and what you do at BIOS versus what you actually studied at Kutztown. Is that true?
I would say that my experience, my research experience has a lot to do with it. So your question is my degree versus my experience, like what contributed more to me getting the job. So, you know, I would definitely say that both were equal factors. If I didn't have a degree from Kutztown, then there's no way they would have considered me. But then again, if I wasn't working towards a degree, I wouldn't have gotten this research experience. So I feel like the research experience is just proof that I went above and beyond, you know, what a normal student does. And I can just picture my professor laughing right now because of me saying going above and beyond, because I know I wasn't the best student ever, but I was, you know, really deeply focused on the research and, you know, driven to do that sort of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I think we talked about this a couple episodes with Mark. We came to the conclusion that motivation has a huge part to play in the science field, and especially when you're doing research. I don't have this experience with that personally, but I can definitely see that being the case. And I see that evident in what you're saying, Nick, and what Mark has previously said in the previous episode. So motivation is critical if you want to do something in the science field, especially research.
Yeah. I mean, I work with undergrads all the time, and I will say that hopefully they're not listening to this podcast. Like, some of them are extremely motivated and they're great, but others are like not motivated whatsoever and they're really bad. Like, you'll know pretty quickly who's going to make it in research and who's not, regardless of how smart they are. Like, you just have kind of a general knack for, or like you're able to know, like, you just know if you're going to be good in research pretty quickly. Like, the ones that suck, and it's almost unfair that like people like me, or like people who are higher up, if they can identify someone who's good at research, they definitely foster their talent a lot more than someone who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, like, you know, there's no place for people in science that consider it like just a job, right? You know, most people, you at least have to consider it a career, but I think most people feel like they have a calling to be a scientist or something like that.
Yeah. So kind of, I guess this is a question and this is off script a little bit, but so as a, I guess, immunologist now, right? And we look at, we're funded through the government. I don't know if we're actually going to talk about BIOS funding or whatever, but for people who are in the medical sciences and stuff like that, who get funding from the NIH or the NSF, it's almost like being a Renaissance artist and equating that to be a scientist in modern day, is what I've understood. Because you really need, back in the Renaissance era, you had if you were a painter, there were millions of painters back then, right? Kind of like there are now in today's science. There's millions of scientists. And literally only the good Renaissance artists were able to get funding for their paintings. And that's the same case today. You have to be a really good scientist to get funded by the NIH. And so it's really hard for just young people to get their foot in the door. It's ridiculous, because scientists today, they don't age out. They're not retiring because they're not dying, and they're not retiring. So they just keep their funding forever and ever and ever. And so it's just really tough. Like, but I don't, is that what you're seeing too in BIOS? Like, I don't, it's a little bit different, right? But do you kind of get that same idea?
Yeah, I definitely have a really good sample size of all the different oceanography, you know, research projects out there. Since I've been on, you know, many different ships and with many different science parties and everything. And yeah, I definitely agree that it's difficult to get the funding. I know some extremely talented, really smart people that are doing some really interesting work, and, you know, it takes them 10 years to get funding for one, you know, one thing. And I think that a big problem is that, like, there's not enough money going towards science in general, right? Yeah. And I definitely think that it's not just, I don't think there's an overpopulation problem of scientists as much as there's just a underfunding problem. you know, I think there's definitely a lot of scientists, and it's you know, growing, but you know, our lives are surrounded by science and technology nowadays, and it's, you know, it's around us all the time, and it's a big part of the economy. And I think you know, I think there should definitely be more investments in, you know, STEM education and, you know, STEM research, because there's much to be desired in the funding of these things, like the National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where BIOS, Bermuda Institute of Ocean Sciences, gets their funding from, those type of institutions?
Yeah. So let me make a comparison here. So, there, you know, the money that BIOS brings in from the National Science Foundation, which is its primary funder, is two orders of magnitude less than a similar oceanographic institution that gets the primary part of its funding from the Navy. And, you know, we virtually do the same research, and we're potentially capable of doing the same, you know, the same scope of work too, but, you know, it's orders of magnitude less through the National Science Foundation.
Okay, so there's a very clear, I guess, weighting towards defense versus science for the sake of science.
Yeah, and actually the Navy does tons of really good research too, and it's overlaps a lot. It's just interesting how it's divided up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely, and so, like, even for health research, like biomedical studies, it's tough to get those DOD grants, because you may have something along the lines of I work with intestinal parasites, and obviously if you have warfighters fighting in the jungles of Southeast Asia or something like that, and they're drinking contaminated water, then, like, my research is relevant. But the problem with the DOD funding is that it's way too politicized. So unless, like, a senator or a congressman is contacted by their constituents or something like that, then usually those projects aren't going to be funded. So it's like the government DOD money in particular, unless there's, like, a mandate for it from the president or someone else, the likelihood of you getting that money is not happening. You know, unless you have an in, but most people don't have an in.
And that's a really huge point to what Tony said about doing science for the sake of doing science, right? Like, most of the biggest discoveries that we've made in, you know, the past few centuries or whatever have come from research that is just for the sake of research, right? It's just following, you know, the curiosities of a scientist and following, you know, asking questions that are directed at just things that we have that are completely black boxes to us that we have no idea how they work, and just, you know, trying to open up the black box and see what's inside. And, you know, that's how a lot of huge developments came about. And, you know, I feel like that's an issue with public perception too, is most of the public thinks that scientists are just, all scientists are doing applied science. And I don't think they understand that there's also a very important role for basic science as well, that doesn't have a direct, you know, application to something.
So would you say that BIOS is a institution that does science for the sake of science? Do they get any funding from defense or anything like that?
We don't get any funding from defense as far as I know. We get most of our funding from NOAA and the National Science Foundation and a little bit from NASA.
What is, like, a project or a research project that BIOS works on that, you know, maybe is well known, or what's their bread and butter, would you say?
Yeah, so we have one of the most well-known climate studies in the world. So the bread and butter of BIOS is the BATS program, at least in my opinion. So,
like, the animal?
The BATS program is it's an acronym that stands for the Bermuda Atlantic Time Series, and it's been going on since 1978, and it's what I work on all the time. Every month, what we do is we go out to one spot in the ocean, the same spot every time, and we drop some instruments in the water on the end of a cable. And the cable's long enough, and we drop those instruments, and they go all the way to the seafloor, and they come back up. And what those instruments measure are the temperature, the salinity, the dissolved oxygen in the water, and also the chlorophyll from the plankton in the water. And those are the core variables in physical oceanography. And so it's kind of like the backbone. That data set there since 1978 is kind of the backbone of a lot of climate research and a lot of other oceanography research that's being done today. So it's really an honor, actually, to be a part of that, because that's been going on for so long. And it was actually an expansion of a time series that was started in, I think, somewhere around 1960, and that time series is also started at Bermuda at the biostation, and actually that's the longest time series of any oceanography project in the world. And we have temperature data of the ocean that dates all the way back to, I think, right around 1960.
Wow, that's amazing. And
that's awesome.
Yeah,
sounds like lots and lots and lots of data. Which is great. Like, the more data, the better when it comes to science. Do you guys share that data with other people, like other institutions?
Yeah. So my job on the ship is to make sure that all those instruments that we lower into the water work. But there's other technicians that come out and scientists that come out, and their job is to process the data and then put it on the internet. And it's available to everybody. And it's one of the most cited data sets in the world. And so that's for the Atlantic Ocean. There's a similar time series that goes on based out of Hawaii for the Pacific Ocean. And between those two data sets, that's where a lot of our knowledge about, you know, the history of the climate of the ocean comes from.
That's so cool. Yeah, like you said, that's really cool to be a part of that and to contribute to that.
So Nick, you've been out around Bermuda on a boat very often. So question for you, is the Bermuda Triangle real? And if so, what is the cause for it?
So the Bermuda Triangle, and I've investigated this, the Bermuda Triangle is definitely real.
Oh, wow. Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the Bermuda Triangle is when you look on a map and you put your pen on Bermuda, and then you draw a line down to Miami, and then you draw a line from there to Puerto Rico, and then back up to Bermuda, you get a triangle. And that's a real triangle if you draw that on a map, right? That's, that exists. The stories, the conspiracy theories and all that sort of stuff, that's all, you know, you got to take every story with a grain of salt, and, you know, each story is its own thing, but it's
they're all flat earthers,
I think. Yeah. There is one really depressing thing. The conspiracy theorists beat out the scientists in the Bermuda Museum. There used to be this really cool exhibit on like the deep ocean biology and all this, you know, all the crazy organisms that live down there, and they actually tore it down and replaced it with a Bermuda Triangle exhibit that's all these conspiracies and all this sort of stuff that attracts the public, but it doesn't, like, you know, it's not scientific in nature at all.
that's terrible.
My understanding of that whole thing is that if you draw a triangle in another location of the world with the same, I guess, traffic patterns for ships and airplanes and whatnot, you'll get the same exact percentage of mysterious disappearances as the Bermuda Triangle. So there's nothing special about the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, there definitely is something special about the Bermuda Triangle because it's in Hurricane Alley, right? It's where lots of hurricanes go. they all start off in like Africa, and then they go through the Caribbean, and then they go right up the Gulf Stream and everything, and that goes right through. That makes that combined with all of the transit lines for ships that are transporting cargo from Europe to the Caribbean and then from the Caribbean up to, you know, the East Coast of America. That's kind of like a hub where there's lots of traffic. There's lots of cargo traffic. So naturally, there's going to be more ships and more hurricanes in that location. So you're going to get more sea stories out of that location. Yeah. And probably, you know, airplane crashes as well. Just because your sample size is so big there.
It's just the geographical region.
Exactly.
Right? Just like, yeah. Well, that makes sense.
That's my understanding of it, at least.
No, I mean, that makes perfectly good sense, though. It's like, it's just north of the equator so much that it just, that's just the natural flow of the hurricanes.
Exactly.
Right?
So yeah. We going with myth busted?
I think myth busted, yeah.
All right, it's fair
we
enough.
You just debunked all the Bermuda Triangle theories at once there.
Nice work, guys. Yeah, so we're running short on time here, and I want to make sure we get to this last topic. I know we talked a lot about bio specifically, but from talking to Nick in prior occasions, I know there's a lot more institutions similar to bios that exist out there. And the reason I want to bring this up is because there potentially are lots of opportunities for people potentially interested in a similar career path as Nick. So Nick, could you speak on that for a little bit? Talk about maybe similar institutions such as BIOS and what they do and maybe your experience at other institutions.
Yeah, so it's funny you say that. I just gave a talk at a middle school in Reading telling people about all the different opportunities there are out there, and there's so many. And as a, you know, as somebody growing up in Reading, Pennsylvania, I was unaware of any of them. And so that's why, you know, now I'm trying to like make people as familiar with these opportunities as possible, because they're such cool things to do. There's like, they're fulfilling jobs, they're adventurous jobs, they're challenging jobs and everything. And there's lots of them available, including internships to get you trained up to do these things. So you asked about the other institutions that do this. So during my internship, I got to go experience cruises on the University of Washington ship, which is the Thomas G. Thompson, and two of the University of Hawaii ships, the Kaimi Kai O Kanaloa and the or the KOK for short.
Oh my god. Yeah.
and then the Kilauea, which is their other one. And yeah, so I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I spent 6 months out at sea for this internship, and that internship flew me to Samoa, and that's where I started my internship. And when I got there, you know, I had been on that ship before, actually, as an undergrad. That's where Dr. Oakley's cruise was. And that ship is so much bigger than the ship that I'm on right now. And it does geology cruises, it does physical oceanography cruises, and it does biology cruises. It's slightly more capable than the ship that I'm on right now. So that ship, run by the University of Washington, what we did on that cruise was we actually mapped the seafloor. And what's crazy about that is we used, like I said, you can only transmit sound underwater. You can't send radio waves underwater. So you can't use radar or, you know, satellite imagery or anything like that. You actually literally just send a sound through the water, and then you just wait for the echo. And there's some really fancy computers that analyze that echo and say, okay, well, according to this echo, there's a mountain over here, and there's a valley over here, and there's this little shipwreck over here. And they're able to, these instruments, these sonar instruments, are able to map the seafloor from when the seafloor is miles away from the ship. So in the deepest parts of the ocean, so which are 6 6,000 meters deep or something. And then even in the trenches, which are 10,000 meters deep.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Was that the same boat where the poop splattered all over the walls?
I think this is my favorite sea story ever, actually.
Oh my God. Okay.
So, you know, Mark did say he studies intestinal parasites, so
it's nothing comes close to what I deal with, so that's all right.
Well, we'll see. So after my time on the University of Washington ship, I flew over to the University of Hawaii. And, you know, everyone's jealous of me being out in Hawaii, getting paid to be on a ship, going to sea and everything, and doing all this cool stuff. And we went out to sea, and we were studying geology. We actually, we were mapping the seafloor, but we were also lowering these little shovels, basically, that would go down. And they would capture some sediment from the seafloor, and then they would bring it back up. So, you know, it would basically bring up mud samples from the seafloor, which is, again, miles beneath us. So we would bring it up, we would drop it on deck, and then the deck would get all muddy and everything. And the first time we did this, the first time we actually caught some mud from the seafloor, we landed it on the back deck, and I was on the back deck, and then it made the deck all messy and brown and everything. And then all of a sudden, I start hearing screaming from inside the labs. And after we get everything settled on the back deck, we run inside, and similarly, it's also covered in brown water. And then there was a scientist that was trapped behind this river of brown water, and they were in the laboratory, and we threw him some rain boots because we saw that this river of brown water was coming from the toilets. And and then they put on the rain boots and waded through the brown river, and then came to the other side. And then we thought, you know, okay, well, the toilet overflowed, that this is a massive disaster, but we had no idea what actually happened. So then an engineer on the ship came by, and the engineer said, oh boy, what's going on here? And we explained to them that, oh, the toilet must have overflowed, this is a massive mess, but we'll just have to clean it up now. And the engineer said, oh crap, I know what's happening. And the engineer went running away, and we didn't know what was going on, but we kind of went running after him to see what was going on. And we realized that it was happening all over the ship. Every toilet on the ship was still overflowing with brown water. So,
oh my.
So, you know, we were about 4 days from the nearest land at this point. So it was all up to us to clean it all up. So how this happened was, you know, somebody down in the engine room had put a fire hose up to the plumbing to get something that was clogging the toilets out. And they had thought that they turned the valves a certain way, but they didn't. And then they put the fire hose up to it and blasted all of the water from the sewage plumbing right back up into the toilets. And the pressure and everything just brought all that brown water up back to the heads. And then it spilled out. In my room, in my stateroom, in my cabin where I sleep, it had spilled into the carpet and everything. My poor roommate was asleep at the time, and I ran up to wake him up, and I saw these brown footprints leaving the room, and then I looked inside, and it was all messy and everything. we spent the next day cleaning up or tearing up the carpets and, you know, bleaching everything. And it was a good you know, group effort there, where we all came together as a team and did something as a crew there. The funniest part of that whole thing was the fact that the cook slept through the entire thing, because the cook takes a break in the middle of the day. And then by the time the cook woke up to make dinner, we were basically cleaned up. We cleaned up all the rivers of brown, and so we had all donned hazmat suits at this time, because it was just a mess. And so the cook just thought that this was some science project going on, and had no idea that we had just had like a poop apocalypse. And And so the cook went down and made the soupiest beef stroganoff with chocolate ice cream for dessert for dinner. And so after an entire afternoon of cleaning up these brown rivers of poop, we had soupy brown beef stroganoff and chocolate ice cream for dinner.
How appropriate.
Yeah, really. Well, I hate to end the podcast on such a shitty note, but unfortunately we're out of time for today. And I hope that last story there doesn't deter anybody from following in your footsteps, Nick. I want to thank you again for taking the time to be on this podcast episode with us. I'm sure we'll have you on the podcast in the future, so you're welcome to come back anytime. Anything else you want to say, Mark, before we sign off here?
No, it's awesome hearing from you, Nick. We've never really talked about science before, and so it's awesome to hear your perspectives and your stories. So I look forward to having you back on the podcast for the STEM talk. That'd be really interesting whenever we get that in. But it's cool. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, I'm excited. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. We'll see you later.
All right. See ya.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode. Please follow us on Twitter at the 451 Podcast to keep up with the latest news and events. If you have any suggestions for episodes or would like to contact us, shoot us an email at the451podcast@gmail.com.